Coming up,
what exactly is misogyny?
Bullying, sexist, and I hate to say it, misogynistic.
I have no idea what that means.
When I pulled my hamstring, I went to a misogynist.
In the 21st century, why are we still dealing with misogyny?
Have we become so habituated to misogyny that we don't even notice it anymore?
All these women are coming out to say that they've also been sexually harassed. And men are like, I can't believe this! And I'm like, I know you can't!
Are you fake just like a woman?
What's the difference between misogyny and sexism?
Can women be misogynist too?
I mean, that's just like the rules of feminism.
But you break just like a little girl.
Our guest is Kate Mann from Cornell University.
Author of Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher, thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being our partner. You've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that support. But we really need your help. We really need it now.
So here's what you do. Go to our website, philosophytalk.org, click the donate button, and help us make more of what we know you love.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating. Does the Me Too movement mark a turning point in gender relations?
Or will men continue to oppress women in the workplace and in the family?
Why does gender inequality persist?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Deborah Satz.
And I'm Ken Taylor.
We're here in the studios of KALW in San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Deborah and I teach philosophy.
Today, we're thinking about misogyny and gender inequality.
You know, Deborah, all over the world, men enjoy power and privilege relative to women. Unfortunately, it's always been that way, and I fear it always will be that way.
You know, can I have more hope than that? At least in some countries, women have made a lot of progress. Just think, 100 years ago in the United States, women couldn't vote. Now you find us occupying positions at the top of the social hierarchy. We're CEOs, we're scientists, we're lawyers, we're senators.
Yeah, but don't forget about the Me Too movement. Deborah, that shows you how far we still have to go. I mean, women are still disproportionately the victims of sexual violence. They still earn less than men. They still do the lion's share of work in the household. So we got a long way to go.
Of course it's bad for women, Ken. But you know what? Patriarchy is bad for men, too.
Oh, come on. What is this? You surprised me. What, you got some brief for the oppressed male or something like that?
No, but I want to recognize that masculinity can be toxic not just for women, but also for men.
Oh, come on. I don't buy that at all.
Well, I mean, men are more likely to die as soldiers in war, more likely to end up in prison, more likely to get beat up. And also, you know, they miss out on their children's lives. Women were better educated. And you know what? We tend to have more friends.
Deborah, okay, all that stuff. Are you really, seriously, trying to deny that women are the oppressed or that men are their oppressors in this patriarchal society?
Of course not. No, I understand the ways that women are treated as second-class citizens. Me too.
Well, you too. So what's your point then?
Look, men clearly benefit from sexism and misogyny, but it's not all benefit. Men are losers too.
No, the oppressors are never the losers. You know, whatever disadvantages men have, they pale in comparison to the disadvantages of oppressed women. You know that saying, even if the master's house is empty and, you know, by your lights, kind of lonely, he still owns the house, Deborah.
Yeah, but some men don't own houses.
Yeah, but even those men still dominate women who own even less.
Yeah, but that's because they're part of a gendered culture that sets them on a path early on that equates masculinity with oppressing women.
You're trying to deny that men have free will or something? Men aren't just victims of patriarchy. Men are the agents of patriarchy, Deborah.
You know, I think you might be overestimating the amount of agency that individual men have in patriarchy. Norms and social structures dictate so much of gender injustice.
You know, that sounds really profound, but what on earth are you talking about?
Okay, take an example. Take the norm that women do most of the child rearing. That norm feeds into the fact that women earn less than men at work. And that fact makes it more economical for them to do the child rearing. It's a vicious and self-reinforcing cycle.
I get your point. I'll concede a point. But here's the thing. How do you break that cycle? You got an idea?
Well, I think social policies help. Policies like early and affordable child care and flexible work times.
See, you're still being the old optimist. You're such an optimist. You know what's going to happen if you put more women in the workplace? And you know what you'll get? You'll get more sexual assault, more harassment. You know why that is? Because it's an inescapable fact. Men hate women who encroach on their territory. It's an inescapable fact, Deborah.
You know what? Misogyny is not just about hate.
Oh, come on. Then how do you explain the Harvey Weinsteins of the world then?
Power. They get off on their power. But I don't think it's about hate. Some misogynists actually love women.
Misogynists love women? Come on. With love like that, who needs hate? Okay, look, maybe they love women as objects or something, but they don't love women as full human subjects?
You might have something there. I'm not sure. But that's an interesting perspective that we're going to find out more about today. First, we've sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to explore some of the ways misogyny has played out from the Book of Genesis to Janet Jackson. She files this report.
When asked about the Me Too movement in an ABC interview, Matt Damon explains that sexual harassment and assault exist on a spectrum.
There's a difference between, you know, patting someone on the butt and rape or child molestation, right?
You can find another example of this type of modern misogyny on the MSNBC talk show, Morning Joe. Host Mika Brzezinski and the other news personalities discuss the importance of due process for accused men.
I'm stricken. I'm chilled by some of the cases I'm seeing now of people being run out of their jobs, bankrupted, and absolutely no due process.
I will say again.
Misogyny is not about individual men. It's systematic, the undercurrent keeping men at the top and women down. Growing up, I was fascinated by stories about women who clashed against gendered expectations and fell hard. And no woman fell harder than Eve. Literary historian Stephen Greenblatt is the author of The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve.
This story has been responsible for the shaping of misogyny, the encouragement of misogyny, the punishment, literal beating in many cases of women, for the last several thousand years.
In the Book of Genesis, Eve is created from Adam's rib. When the hungry pair eat the forbidden fruit in the Garden of Eden, they're both punished. Adam gets eternal sorrow, but Eve gets eternal submission.
The story is turned into an explanation for why women should submit and be silent.
Jump from the beginning of humankind to the 1990s, and narratives about sinful women are everywhere, even on the ice skating rink.
Here comes Tanya Harding.
Tanya Harding grew up in a trailer, put out cigarettes with skating blades, and landed triple axels to the Batman soundtrack.
Great power, great speed, and great athletic ability.
Judges marked her down for lacking femininity and elegance. In a scene from the 2017 biopic, I, Tanya, she confronts the judges.
I outskated him today.
We also judge on presentation.
If you can come up with $5,000 for a costume for me, then I won't have to make one.
After Tanya's abusive ex-husband hires a hitman to club skating rival Nancy Kerrigan in the knee, Tanya turns into one of the most despised people in the country.
Nancy gets hit one time.
Why? Why?
And the whole world sh**. For me, it's an all-the-time occurrence.
Jump to the 2004 Super Bowl, and Janet Jackson takes the fall after Justin Timberlake pulls off her outfit, exposing her right breast. By the end of this song. The stunt derailed Jackson's career, with tabloids calling her a slut and networks banning her songs, even while broadcasting Timberlake's hits.
The whole thing went wrong in the end. I am really sorry.
Growing up, I practically collected stories of disgraced, fallen women. They were my heroes, my metaphors, my mirrors, my warning flags. I didn't expect the 2016 presidential campaign to be a part of the collection.
I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it.
After Donald Trump bragged about groping women in the Access Hollywood tape, he defended himself during the presidential debates.
Are you saying that what you said on that bus 11 years ago, that you did not actually kiss women without consent or grope women without consent?
I have great respect for women. Nobody has more respect for women than I do.
During the MSNBC Commander-in-Chief Forum, Trump and Clinton were invited to talk about their foreign policy plans. Host Matt Lauer spent most of the show interrupting Clinton with questions about her emails.
Some of the emails sent or received by you referring to our drone program, and you said you thought your communications on that were fairly choice.
Then, when an audience member asked Clinton about how she'll determine where to deploy troops to combat ISIS,
as part of it, we're going after Baghdadi, the leader, because it will help us focus our attention, just like going after bin Laden helped us focus our attention in the fight against Al-Qaeda in the Afghanistan-Pakistan theater.
I am fast running out of time.
Months later, in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein scandal, the Me Too movement gave women a platform to share their stories and hold men accountable. Some of the same men who covered the presidential race, from Matt Lauer to Charlie Rose, lost their jobs for sexual misconduct. Women are still sharing their experiences of abuse. But when there's a dent in these stories, the moment they get too nuanced, the backlash begins and the patriarchy falls back into place. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that. A tour of misogyny's greatest hits, Holly. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Deborah Satz. And today we're thinking about gender inequality.
We're joined now by Kate Mann. Kate's professor of philosophy at Cornell University, and she's the author of an important new book, Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny. Kate, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
So, Kate, misogyny isn't really a topic that philosophers have written a lot about. I mean, written a lot about sexism and feminism, but not misogyny. So what first got you interested in this topic?
Well, I was one of three girls at an all-boys school the year that it integrated during my last 2 years of high school. So I think that was probably somewhat of a formative experience that when I became a philosopher kind of shaped my interest in having a name for some of the problems that were really hard to articulate back then.
Seems like a pretty half-hearted integration.
Three girls
in a whole school of hundreds of boys?
That could leave you scarred for life.
Yeah, it kind of did, but in a way that left me wanting to be a philosopher who got to professionally disagree with people and in a way that was civil and welcome rather than something that was silenced and shunned.
So, Kate, in the opening, Ken and I were talking about gender inequality, and I was trying to make the point that although gender inequality is bad for women, and although it benefits men, it also has some cost to men. And Ken was disagreeing. So what do you think?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't find myself disagreeing, Deborah, with much of what you said, but I do think there's a worrying tendency as soon as the discussion of patriarchy or misogyny or sexism comes up, there's this interesting kind of shift in sympathetic moral attention to focus on boys and men as the victims somehow of whatever rather than its agents and perpetrators. So it's not that, sure, patriarchy does hurt men, but as Ken said, it also benefits them. And I really think that it pays philosophically and politically to keep our focus on ways in which girls and women, as well as non-binary folks, are really policed and punished for certain kinds of deviance.
Yeah, I get you, and I agree with you. And, you know, I mean, our opening is like to frame different possibilities. But there is a thing. I mean, I don't think you believe in like intersectionality. I don't want to insult you or something at all, but I think you're much more privileged than a black guy in the ghetto in the prison.
Totally.
So and it's I don't know if it's a single hierarchy because there's all these interacting parts to it. So
yeah, no, that's absolutely right. In fact, another reason why I wrote the book was to try to spend a little bit of that coin of my privilege, because I'm privileged in every way bar gender, including, you know, cultural capital, having a professor father. So, you know, why not work on maximally unpleasant topics that are also under discussed?
So how do we currently? But, which raises the question, we think about these separate them out, or do we need to think about their interactivity, or how do you think about just methodologically?
So in my intersectional analysis of misogyny, what I like to do is to compare girls and women to their male counterparts, that is boys and men. So that will be holding fixed things like race, class, sexuality, being cis versus trans, being disabled or non-disabled. So often I think it is useful to hold fixed all the intersecting social factors bar gender and see if there is a systematic advantage to men in a similar position.
Okay, so we'll have to dig into that more after a short break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about gender inequality and misogyny with Kate Mann from Cornell University.
In our next segment, we're going to dive into the nature of sexism and misogyny. Is there a difference between the two? And if so, why is it important to distinguish them?
Misogyny, gender inequality, and sexism, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues. How could anyone keep quiet in the face of persistent gender inequalities? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Deborah Satz, and we're probing the nature of gender inequality. Our guest is Kate Mann, professor of philosophy at Cornell and author of the timely, important book, Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny.
So, Kate, in your book, you distinguish misogyny from sexism. I don't think that's a distinction that was on the tip of everybody's tongue. I'm not sure how people think about that. So tell us a little bit about what you think the difference is between misogyny on the one hand and sexism on the other.
Yeah, so I think of sexism as an ideology or a set of beliefs or a theory that women are quote-unquote naturally inferior to men in certain masculine-coded domains like STEM fields and business and politics and, philosophy for that matter. So sexism is kind of this bad science. And I say bad science because often we don't yet know what men's and women's natural proclivities are because we lack a control group in a patriarchal culture. So that's sexism, and I think of misogyny as kind of the law enforcement branch of patriarchy that serves to police and enforce these kinds of social roles for girls and women when the ideology doesn't suffice to keep girls and women in their place.
So can I ask you, how detachable are these then? If mm-hmm. you know, can you be a misogynist without being a sexist on your view? Or if this is an enforcement, is it an enforcement of an ideology the person holds?
Yeah, suppose I don't believe in sexism. Can I still be a misogynist? Because I do.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think so. Because as well as beliefs here, there can be desires that are, in fact, very anxious and fearful desires if there's no firm belief in the ideology of sexism to back them up. So the idea that you want women to be inferior in certain ways because it would be convenient in order to exclude them from male-dominated areas and to keep them in feminine-coded social roles of giving, loving, nurturing. Yeah, if you have that desire without the sexist belief, then anxiety is kind of the name of the
game. But don't people almost always rationalize that desire by trying to come up with a theory that, you know, justifies it? And is, you know, if pushed, won't they say, you know, in some way, this is natural roles?
I think they sometimes do that. I think that's one of the many ways you can rationalize. But because when it comes to individual women, you can also often moralize and find ways to hold that women don't deserve certain kinds of perks or powers or positions because, well, she's just kind of abrasive, or she just seemed vaguely dishonest or untrustworthy. There are just other ways, I think, to go when it comes to these moves.
So you're putting, as one might well, a negative spin. She's kind of abrasive, this, that, and the other thing, right? Suppose that the feminine virtues, as it were, are different from the masculine virtues. That is, and it's not that you think you put women on some kind of pedestal. The Catholic Church believes in certain kind of feminine virtues. Mm-hmm. They don't really think of those as negative things. I mean, one of the things our roving reporter left out is of the story that goes from Eve. It doesn't stop with Eve. There comes the Virgin Mary, right, who gives birth to God, who is the salvation of the world, and they worship the Virgin Mary, and the sisters of Christ and the nuns try to be like the Virgin Mary, and that's really good. That's not bad, right? That's not negatively coded in their view,
quite terrific, within that ideological framework.
So what if
great point. I think that misogyny likes to separate out good women from bad women, and putting quote-unquote good women on a pedestal for conforming to feminine-coded social roles, being incredibly giving and loving and nurturing, which are real virtues but ought to be balanced between people of any gender. I think we have women who are valorized and lionized but also are in this very precarious position, because if she stops giving or starts asking, then she's liable to fall from that pedestal abruptly and to fall hard.
Okay, so I want to understand more about the extent of the separation. And in your book, you have a wonderful line.
Between
sexism and misogyny. And the wonderful line is, misogyny is what misogyny does. And so that's about the enforcement of various kinds of gendered norms that subordinate women. But there are a lot of things that subordinate women where it's not obvious that the motivations behind them, can be diagnosed as, residing in hate or fear or, desires to put women down. So take, controls over women's reproduction, which we know, has a function, which is it makes women more vulnerable, subordinate, it endangers their health, has all kinds of, consequences for women's equality. But it's not obvious that people who support these kinds of restrictions are therefore holding views that, on grounds of misogyny, we would criticize. Because it's not, they may hold those views because they have a different view of when life starts.
Yeah, no, I think that's right among individual people who've acquired the ideology. But I will say that in the early 70s, just before Roe v. Wade, the importing of a very small piece of Catholic ideology in the form of treating the fetus as a person, which, Catholic ideology being a metaphysical package deal, which it's hard to just take a piece of that. This was an AstroTurf deliberate campaign to get Nixon elected. And the way that they thought that would work is by reinforcing gender roles, by making people very anxious about women having too much reproductive freedom. So individuals, I agree.
That's true. That's true. You're right about Nixon. They were utterly cynical. But part of that, and you even mentioned this in this book, reinforcing gender roles. It wasn't just female gender roles. They said, the cultural type of women being mothers and caring for children, and men going off to die at war. We want to use that, the challenge
the
to that.
Draft dodges.
So they wanted to keep men in their place too, right?
Yeah, that's true. So it was the AAA strategy, amnesty, acid, and abortion. Mm-hmm. So no more amnesty for draft dodges. So that's completely accurate. I think, given recent forms of equality in the military, it's now kind of less clear, I think, whether that desire to keep those sorts of roles for men exclusively, how they cash out politically, I think, is actually a bit complicated and shifting. But, I mean, the crucial thing is that there's a combination of wanting certain men, you know, including working class men, to be good pawns under capitalism. And there's also a wanting to reserve for white men, including white working class men, who are a subcategory of working class men, the more privileged kinds of work over say men of color.
All right, Kate. So one of the, we have some people waiting to break into our conversation, and on a similar theme about, you know, is misogyny just aimed at injuring women? And so we have a comment from Nancy from Los Gatos, who writes, "One area in which misogyny injures men is in relationships. Women are aware of their historic treatment and asymmetry, and this can set up difficulty in establishing healthy relationships." But so because men have been problematic, women don't want much to do with them. That's, I guess, the gist of the call. So what do you think?
What do you think about that?
That's an odd perspective. So abusive relationships almost, so say certain kinds of domestic violence like strangulation, it's almost always men who are the perpetrators, and it's extremely difficult to get women to testify against their abusers.
Yeah,
so
I'm not
seeing women as leaving these relationships, and I'm also not seeing men as the victims.
I don't think that's what Nancy's talking about. No. I think she's talking about just ordinary male-female relationships. Once women become aware of the historic treatment and asymmetry, as she puts it, men are indifferent to their needs, that and the other thing, they are less inclined to want to have those relationships with men. She's not talking about strangulation. She's just talking about
you don't
buy Nancy's perspective.
Well, I mean, a third of relationships do involve domestic violence, so I'm really cautious about saying ordinary relationships here. But
point taken.
I think that look, there are lots of women who play very subordinate roles in heterosexual relationships, despite understanding at a rational level that they're not obligated to. I think there is a lot of kowtowing to his wants and needs in ways that are really problematic.
So let's get some callers in here. Lisa from San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Lisa. What's your comment or question?
Yes, oftentimes we look at misogyny in a very isolated situation as if that's happening on its own, but without looking at the systemic issues. And it's really no coincidence that in the man camps that are created around the oil pipelines around the country, there is the highest incident of rape and kidnapping of Native American women and children. Mm-hmm. Basically, the extractive kind of system that we have and the plundering of Mother Nature is directly related to the world view of misogyny towards women and against the nurturing of our nature, basically. And I think it brings to mind Diane Rochelot, feminist political ecology. I don't think we can separate ourselves from the Mother Earth in that respect. I think we need to look at that within the context of the system, the extractive kind of system that we have.
Thanks for the call, Lisa. Deborah, you want to respond to this?
Kate, I'm interested in, but I would say, look, capitalism is a key part of this story. I mean, the extractive relationship we have with nature is so governed by, you know, the desire to make profit off of the raw materials of the world and the without concern for the third-party costs it imposes on other people.
Yeah, I was going to agree. I don't think we put that to misogyny as much as capitalism per se, but what do you think, Kate?
Well, actually, it reminded me of what I really like as a metaphor for the dynamic misogyny tries to impose, which is that children's story, The Giving Tree.
Mm-hmm.
So this female tree gives everything she has to her the boy who just asks for more and more, who leaves her branches, her apples. And by the end of it, the boy has like built a house and a boat and made money out of this tree. And she's an amputated stump. So she gives everything she has, and he ends up like a man-child. In some ways harmed, because he never says thank you, so his moral character is certainly questionable. So I guess I think there is a sort of, there's a way in which misogyny tells women to give and give and give, and there should be more balancing of that.
Yeah.
And more respect for, leaving well enough alone.
I'm gonna take you back a second, because I'm not sure if I'm reading your book, and I'm not sure if I'm talking to you now, what you believe about the following question. I think I infer that you believe that any gendered division of labor is bound to be problematic. I'm not sure that's a correct interpretation of you. I'm not sure it's true. I mean, could there be a gendered division of labor that was not morally problematic, on your view?
I think I'd have to hear the details. I think it would be very likely to end up being exploitative. I don't think there's anything to rule out the possibility of, agreements that happen to line up a certain way. But I would want to hear it all spelled out. I'm very suspicious.
There are attempted explanations. You said something about bad science. There are attempted explanations by people like evolutionary psychologists and stuff, social biologists, of various aspects of gender division of labor. Not all, but various aspects that are kind of culturally independent. Even some psychologists like Eleanor Maccabee in the 90s wrote this book called The Two Sexes, in which she argued that children on the playground do gender policing of play styles. Girls are, it's all this kind of stuff. So do you think all that work is just ideology, or is there anything to it, or what?
I mean, parents also nurture boy infants and girl infants very differently. So again, it's just a matter of how much scientific energy is devoted to something that turns out to be very difficult to know for basically John Stuart Mill's
reasons. I was just about to raise John Stuart Mill, who I think was absolutely right in this. He said, we just don't know what men and women would really be like in a world without the kind of gendered norms that structure the subordination of women.
Totally agree with that. Mm-hmm. But doesn't that mean we should try to know and not settle it a priori?
But it's very difficult to know outside of the conditions under which quantum, we continually find men and women.
Quantum theory is hard, too. We don't know whether hidden variable theories are true. Of course, science is about the hard things.
Yeah, but I think we have to often consider where we're pouring energy. And when there's very good evidence that we'll be able to do this science better in a more equal culture, why not wait and devote our scientific energies there to lots of the questions we can investigate productively right now, as opposed to this sort of endless ferreting out of difference that does happen to serve an ideological purpose when it's ferreted out, to say, don't worry too much that women aren't in philosophy, for example.
No, I think
that's
drawing,
what we just expect.
No, I'm not. I think you're
based in their natural.
But I think you're jumping ahead of the game. I think science should take the hardest questions. Otherwise, ideology fills the gap. I don't think we should wait. I think you should do science.
But it's
do
it well.
I think all else equal, we should take the hardest questions. But if we can't know the answers right now, it's hard to see what the epistemic payoff is.
I don't know.
We've got to
take a break here. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We are thinking about misogyny with Kate Mann from Cornell University.
In our final segment, we'll talk about what kinds of policies and practices do we need if we're going to make progress countering women's subordination. Should we look to law? Is there a role for civil society, more Me Too campaigns, education, or all of the above?
A world without misogyny. Can you imagine it? When Philosophy Talk continues. What will it take for women to feel like they're no man's woman? I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Deborah Satz, and our guest is Kate Mann from Cornell University, and we've been having a conversation about gender inequality.
And Deborah, you've got an email
got an email from Maria. So Maria writes, Yoko Ono said it harshly, shockingly, just so truthfully when she said, women is the N-word of the world. She said this in the 1970s, and still we see the abuse and subordination of women everywhere today. Women have come a long way in many countries, but make no mistake, nowhere in the world are women treated equally to men. We focus a lot on racism today, as we should, but women remain overlooked. As Shirley Chisholm said, when I ran for Congress, when I ran for president, I met more discrimination as a woman than for being black. Sometimes when I watch a movie from even as late as the 1990s, I think the change that women in the script to a black man, and people would be appalled as to how he's treated. So, Kate, what do you think?
Strong stuff.
Well, I'm always very cautious of the attempt to draw parallels between gender and race because, of course, they intersect. So as the Chisholm quote nicely brought out, being a black woman, is a distinctive thing, especially in America. So I like Moya Bailey's term misogynoir to capture what might be distinctive and even sui generis about that kind of social experience. But I think more broadly, there's something right both about your observation, Deborah, that women have made enormous progress that you observed in the opening, and the sense that there's still huge strides that need to be made. And I think that progress and backlash go hand in hand. And one of the difficult things is that often progress for the most privileged women, women like me, can play itself out as backlash towards more vulnerable women.
So I want to pick up on one point I think Maria is making. I mean, it's interesting. We've elected a black man as president, but we've never managed to elect a woman as president.
Well, we did, but our rules of the road don't let her be have.
So I wonder if you think that in the recent election, you know, as many people have, you know, noted, there was a lot of misogyny directed to Hillary Clinton, and whether or not that you think was, you know, are we ever going to see a woman president? Was this a case of the policing of the norms? I mean, how do you look at this recent election?
Yeah, I think that there's very good social scientific empirical evidence that when a woman and a man go head to head for a male dominated position, the woman will tend to be systematic biases against her. So people will say if the information is ambiguous that the male candidate is more competent. And if the information is unambiguous that they're equally competent, an equal number will flip to saying he's more likable. And that's about 85% of people will choose him.
But I understand and I know this work. But, you know, this is complicated because lots of women have beaten lots of men in elections. Hillary Clinton beat two men in her Center for the Election. And I have to say, if you just look at the plebiscite, she beat Donald Trump. That's his name, that dude whose name I don't like to say. She beat Donald Trump by as many votes as George Bush beat John Kerry almost, just a few hundred thousand less. So,
how did he get any votes?
Well, that's a good question, Kate. That's a really good question.
And
there is this thing, white women put him over the top to the extent. Mm-hmm. But if you just take the measure of the popular sentiment, she beat him by 3 million votes.
Yeah, but
close election.
I think misogyny is definitely a big part of the story, but it's not the only part of the story. I mean, people were really unhappy with the status quo, and there are a lot of people who've been left out, and they're angry. And this was also has to be understood that way, you know, that he got votes because people were angry.
Yeah. I mean, people were angry, but I don't think we should take their word for it that they were left out, as opposed to just not being the center of moral attention politically. So there was an enormous amount of what I'd call sympathy for the white male working class.
But there are a lot
Trump
of people
voting,
who are really hurting. There are a lot of people who are really hurting.
But pain
country.
And oppression are different things.
Yeah, but I would agree that the many white males in this country feel rightly crushed by the forces of capitalism and the globalization of the economy, rightly so, and that the way of life that they envision is hardly available to them. And they saw Hillary Clinton and the whole Democratic Party and the Republican establishment as more of that. But that's a big issue. We got it. Let's get Ella from Oakland in. Mm-hmm. Ella, welcome to Philosophy Talk. What's your comment or question?
Okay, thank you. I was at a dinner last night, and we were talking somewhat about this subject. And one man in the dinner said, look, you women are not going to know this because men don't fess up to it too much. But deep down, all men are scared to death of women, not to death, but they're very scared of women, and they're scared of women's power and strength. And they are afraid of being found out. They're afraid of being basically the bluff, their domination. And their supremacy is basically a fraud, and they're afraid of the fraud being called out, almost like the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain. So that's kind of why they have to perpetuate this domination and oppression and violence.
Would you, Ella, would you be willing to amend that to some men, or do you really believe it's all men?
I mean, no, it's not all men. It's not all men. You're right. But it might be the majority of men. And some of it is subconscious. I don't think they're totally conscious of this happening. And it's not all men. I'm sorry.
So thanks for the call, Ella. What do you think, Kate?
Well, I think no need to apologize, especially since you were reporting someone else's view. I think that's a helpful way of thinking about things in some ways. But I do think that... it generalizes in ways that are maybe unduly pessimistic. I mean, I think there absolutely is such a thing as non-toxic masculinity, which actually involves embracing many of the traditionally feminine-coded virtues like nurturing and giving and loving and being prepared to do the kinds of care work that, if white working class men were prepared to accept work in the care industry, they would be a lot better off collectively.
So that maybe that's right. So if that's true, if they would be better off collectively, I have to add, it really goes back to something that Deborah brought up. What do you think keeps patriarchy in place if, objectively, I would be better off if there were not this patriarchal system? I mean, either I benefit disproportionately from it or I'm hurt from it. Mm. And if there's a better system that would, I mean, it's like, what? It's like, this is, I mean, it's kind of like whites in the South, the poor whites in the South under slavery. It's like, why did they fight the plantation owners' war and die in hundreds of thousands? I have never understood this. So is it like you think men just have a kind of false consciousness that's imbued in them by... something?
Well, no, I think this very much goes for white women, by the way, too. But switching costs psychologically can be immense. Just because patriarchy is actively harmful to people, even if the harms outweigh the admitted benefits and incentives, it doesn't follow that really trying to change things, really trying to dismantle those structures will be anything but terrifying.
So where would you start? If you're thinking about like what string to pull on to really make a difference in the attitudes and practices, you know, that structure the opportunities and freedom of men and women, where would you push?
You've got 2 minutes to tell us that, or a minute and a half.
So, if I were queen of the world. Yeah. So I think a big problem, and this is going to sound counterintuitive, is that we're excessively sympathetic to comparatively privileged and dominant men, and thus... and I can justify the thus given an extra half minute, but thus we're very aggressive, hostile, and reluctant to listen to girls and women in particular who testify against them or oppose them in some way. So I think we felt less empathy and were more kind of, not to use a Fox term, but fair and balanced in approaching testimony against men we like, then I think that would be a string to pull that would make a big difference.
Okay.
I think we're running out of time.
No, I think we've ran out of
time. A lot of things to respond to there. But
yes, okay, that's a profound thought. I love that word you use.
Empathy.
First time I've heard it said, empathy. So that's probably going
to
make its way into the lexicon. So on that note, Kate, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Our guest has been Kate Mann. She's a professor of philosophy at Cornell University. She's author of the timely book, Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny. So, Deborah, what are you thinking today? Are you feeling up or down?
I think I'm feeling kind of depressed just at how overwhelmingly hard it is to really make change. Although I continue to think that policy is a better lever than trying to change hearts and minds.
You sound like Hillary Clinton. She said that.
But you know, Kate has convinced me, and thinking more about this, that you know we can't shortcut around changing norms.
Yeah, I think the whole...
It's basically where you start and whether by changing structures you can change norms.
Yeah, it's a very hard problem. And we didn't even talk about the intersection of this problem with all other problems of social structure and oppression. So on that note, on that uplifting note, this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Email your questions to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we might feature it on the blog. And we now turn to an equal opportunity speedster. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, misogyny, according to Cicero, is a fear of women. It all goes back to Eve, I guess, who came from her rib, cuckolded us with a snake, and that's why we all wear clothes today. That's the story. Women, of course, are not yet allowed the luxury of making a fear of men into a pathology, because after all, this is common sense. It's weird how persistent and insidious, even here at the end of history, misogynistic tropes can be. Take the word cuck, for example. Over the past 2 years or so, this has become a go-to insult by the right wing. It came from cuckservative, a portmanteau word combining cuckold and conservative to indicate a person who wears the conservative mantle but does not walk the walk. Cuckservative has been shortened to cuck and means any person, by which they mean any man, who has abandoned his principles, who is weak and betrayed and might not even know it. First, it referred to the right, Jeb Bush, for example, who was viewed as not as politically pure as Donald Trump. I don't know, beats me. I know that cuck comes from cuckold, meaning a man whose wife commits adultery with another man. A great figure of fun in Chaucer and an old morality plays, it sort of hinted around that Joseph, Mary's husband, is a cuckold because he's not really the father of Mary's child. We don't dwell on that too much. The term cuckold comes from cuckoo, which is a bird that lays its eggs in another bird's nest, which kind of seems like more trouble than it's worth. Anyway, I guess because it's outside the norm of morality, cuckolding became a thing, a running joke in the realm of body humor. With a plump burgomeister being cuckolded by the traveling salesman or sly young cobbler with a buxom young wife, generally the husband is the last to know and he's the laughing stock of the village. More recently, cuckoldry entered the realm of pornography, with a whole subgenre devoted to men being willing cuckolds to another man, generally a black man. The difference here is that the cuckolds are not only witting, they are aroused and delighted by the cuckoldry, and we the consumers, I suspect, are meant to be aroused as well, assuming we find that sort of thing arousing. It gets confusing. On the one hand, according to the dictates of racism, as a white man, it should be humiliating for your wife to commit adultery with a black man, not to mention anybody. But from the porno point of view, it indicates that your wife is your erotic plaything, and if others can enjoy her, as it were, it proves your ownership, and therefore, I don't know, what the hell do I know? So a cuck has come to mean an adulterated male, a weakling, someone who doesn't practice what he preaches, a fool, someone desperate for a woman's approval, political lefties in general, a loser, a spineless coward, Jared Kushner, according to Steve Bannon. This cuck business, no doubt, is a sub rosa reaction to Barack Obama being our first African-American president, to Hillary Clinton running for president, to women in general getting a little shirty about the ongoing exercise of privilege by their white male brethren. Poo-poo, say man. Don't be cucky. Say bye-bye to new ones. A confident man is still all you need. Mansplaining is a way of life. Why fight it? So no, cuck might just mean loser, but the entire history of the word is still present, like a ghost in a ruined building, and it is still effective. No matter how you respond to being called a cuck, it reveals you as a cuck. Even calling it toxic masculinity is a very cuckish thing to say, don't you think? On the other hand, the anti-cucks stand revealed as cucks themselves. Pervs who get a rise out of beating lefties. The cuck in all of us stands revealed. A creepy old ghost that only likes to watch. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2018.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Carola Kreitmeyer, Angela Johnston, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners in our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on the program don't necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or any of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Deborah Satz.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Cuckold, cuckold, cuckold.
What's a cuckold?